Some of modern history's biggest wildland fires have occurred in the last decade. To get ahead of the flames, land managers say there's much work to be done thinning forests and performing controlled burns. It's the kind of work that requires a lot of training and collaboration. And by and large, it's the kind of work performed by men. Women occupy only about 10% of wildland fire positions in government agencies, and only 7 out of every 100 leadership roles. The Women in Fire Training Exchange is part of an effort to neutralize this disparity. Known as WTREX, the exchange wrapped up near Whiskeytown in Northern California last week, one aspect of a wide-reaching effort to train thousands of people in our region in collaborative fire management. The University of California and the Nature Conservancy were among many partners involved. Lenya Quinn Davidson is the Area Fire Advisor for the University of California Cooperative Extension and Director of the Northern California Prescribed Fire Council. Lenya, welcome to the exchange.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We also have Amanda Stamper. She's Fire Management Officer for the Nature Conservancy of Oregon. Thanks for joining us, Amanda.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Amanda, I'm going to start with you. You began your career in fire management as a member of a 20-person hand crew back in 1999. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience, kind of where you've been and where are we now with women in the firefighting field?
Yeah, I started my career on a contract hand crew, and I fell in love with the work, and I decided to go ahead and continue doing that work after I graduated from the University of Oregon with a degree in philosophy, which I always jokingly say is what led me into wildland fire. But really, it was the natural environment undergoing a transformation that was really fascinating to me, and I didn't quite understand what was going on at the time because I didn't have a background in ecology or even really science at that time. And so I went back into the work of wildland fire management, working on a fire engine and then moving on to a hotshot crew, which is a step up from a 20-person hand crew, sort of equivalent to the Marines in the military. So very much elite, very well-trained, an incredibly fit group of people. And I competed with my male counterparts or performed with my male counterparts fairly well and found myself capable of doing the work. And so I continued to do it and then ended up complementing my work on the ground with further education to understand better what fire was doing on the landscape. And I knew early on that it was beneficial, but I didn't quite understand why or how. And so that ended up eventually leading me into working in prescribed fire at the same time that I got a master's degree in natural resources and fire ecology. I transitioned into working in the field of prescribed burning and controlled fire to try to sort of turn the tide of what we see on the landscape as really a threat today in terms of wildfires that burn beyond what we really think they should, or in terms of the threats that they have to communities. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, my path.
And I want to circle back into the heart of the nutshell there. You mentioned being on a hotshot crew. How many of your colleagues were other women?
Well, I was the only woman during one of the summers that I worked on that crew.
And how many people on a crew?
20.
20.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking with Amanda Stamper. She's Fire Management Officer for the Nature Conservancy of Oregon. We also have with us Lenya Quinn Davidson of the Northern California Prescribed Fire Council. They've just wrapped up a 2-week training for women in firefighting and fire management. Lenya, I want to bring you in here, Amanda, just relating her experience. Could you describe some of the social and cultural barriers faced by women in firefighting?
Yeah, so, I mean, I almost feel like Amanda might be the better person to answer this, just because I'm coming more from the kind of academic side, and I'm more of a facilitator role for trainings and bringing people together to work on prescribed fire, but I've never actually been on a fire crew and worked in fire suppression like Amanda has.
Yeah.
Amanda might be the better person to speak to that question.
Yeah. Let's kick it over to Amanda. Hi, Amanda.
Sure. So, I like to go back to the beginning of fire suppression to contextualize it. Originally, it was white men in the West that fought fire. And so fire's got a deep cultural history, and it's a rich one, and it's quite beautiful in a lot of ways. Fire brings people together, and it unites them, and there's a real strong brotherhood that formed over time. And that identity with the brotherhood and with the hard work and a fairly masculine approach to fire management. And so I think that naturally developed over time in the absence of women participating. And as women have come into that workforce more in the last 30 to 40 years, well, I'd say, 30 to 40 years, it's been a shift, and it hasn't been smooth necessarily. So, if you talk to different women across the country, they'll give you different stories. Some come from these places where even if they're the only woman, they have this great strong network of brothers that support them, and so they don't feel quite as at odds with the culture. And others end up in places where they really struggle. And I've kind of been somewhere in the middle. I've had both really positive and supported experiences, and I've had some that weren't so positive and well supported. But I think that really connecting women to each other is the key to helping that cultural transition move forward. Because when you talk about 7 out of 100 women in leadership, or you talk about 10% of women in fire, that means they're mostly alone, or there's just a couple of them in any given location. And a lot of these duty stations that women work at are very isolated, and so they don't have a chance to interact with each other. And that was a big reason why the women's treks was such a great experience, is because all of a sudden these women who had not had each other to talk to and network with and become friends with were all in the same place. So I think it has mostly to do with isolation, and it has to do with a deep cultural history that hasn't until recently started to shift. And so it's just taking some time, I think, to change.
Now, Linnea Quinn Davidson, when you are organizing conferences and prescribed fire trainings, when we talk about doing an all-female training exercise or bringing together women in fire, I followed the development of other efforts somewhat similar, women in wildland fire boot camps, for example, mm-hmm. in New Mexico and Arizona. What's the rationale for creating a single-sex versus an integrated training opportunity?
Well, we should be clear that the event that we just hosted, the WTREX, was integrated. And it was actually very intentional that we included men. And so we had about 10 to 15% men. We had some men coming and going throughout the event, but we had a core set of men that participated in the entire training. And that was totally by design, because we didn't want it to be, you know, just a focus on women. We feel that we need to bring men with us as we build new networks and develop a new culture and try to work on some of these issues. So, the men that participated became such important part of the training, not only for the expertise that they brought, but also just kind of opening their eyes to some of the issues that they weren't familiar with. We had one man who was involved who is kind of a young guy on a hotshot crew and didn't really expect, he didn't know what to expect coming into the training. And when he left, he said it was a life-changing experience for him just to hear from the women and to understand what some of his peers are dealing with out in the field. So that was really important part of the training, was to have men involved. And we have some discussion, you know, as we plan trainings, we want to do this again. We want to continue doing it every year. And having a training that is kind of focused on women's leadership and on, you know, bringing women together and building new networks. But we want to definitely include men in that as we move forward.
You're hearing from Linnea Quinn Davidson. She's director of the Northern California Prescribed Fire Council and an advisor at the UC Cooperative Extension. Amanda Stamper is also with us, fire management officer for the Nature Conservancy of Oregon. I'm Emily Curitan, and you're welcome to join this exchange with your own observations, experience, questions about fire management and training, and the inclusion of women in the fireland management workforce. Give us a call at 800-838-3760. Or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. Amanda, this training, it just wrapped up, the WTREX Women in Fire Training Exchange. Take us into a day in the life or a couple of days in the life of this intensive two-week training exchange.
Yeah. So if we were to start from the very beginning, there's orientation and preparations in terms of making sure that everyone is outfitted properly with personal protective equipment, including pants that are designed not to burn, and radios and hard hats and packs with fire shelters. So we have to get everybody outfitted and together on the same page in terms of how we're going to proceed with doing operational work. As we moved into actually conducting broadcast burns, that meaning that we're bringing fire across the landscape in a very controlled and orchestrated fashion, we assign trainee roles to individuals who are working towards becoming qualified to lead burns themselves or to participate within the burn organization to oversee some of the groups within the main organization. So it's structured using what we call the incident command system, which is a paramilitary term, and it has to do with managing span of control. So each person has responsibility for a certain number of people, and that way you're not trying to organize 30 people at one time, for example. So the day before the burn, we'd collect weather observations on site, which we then submit to the National Weather Service to get a site-specific weather forecast, which we require in order to determine whether or not we will be in prescription. Being in prescription means that we anticipate that the winds, the relative humidity, the temperature, et cetera, will be within reasonable terms. So we can't have too high of a wind, it can't be too hot, but it also can't be too cool or we won't meet our prescribed burn objectives. So we, when we get our spot weather forecast back and we start making notifications to the community because we know that we have a favorable forecast, we organize accordingly, make sure that we have all of our equipment in line, meaning we have slash mix or drip torch fuel. We have engines which have water in them and are functioning. All of the participants know what their roles and responsibilities are and are clear on communications and are using the right radio frequencies so that they can all talk to each other. And then once we actually get configured and we have all that pre-planning is in place and done, we start what we call a test fire, and that's to see, is it burning how we think it's going to? We do a modeling beforehand using the weather prescription parameters that we need to make sure that it's going to burn the way we think it's going to, and we set our test fire. We determine whether or not that's meeting objectives and it's controllable, and then we start bringing fire across the unit, and the unit will be bounded with roads or lines, or sometimes we'll just use water to wet down grass. And we organize, what I like to say is the people that are doing the burning part, that are actually putting the fire down, are like the gas on the car, and the people that are holding the burn are like the brakes. And so we coordinate between the two. If the holding resources need us to slow down, they put on the brakes. If we need to build a little bit more intensity with the fire to get the effects that we want, we put on the gas. And then the burn boss is sort of like this conductor, which is a different analogy, where they're trying to coordinate everyone so that it flows smoothly and you don't have that any problems between the gas and the brakes, if you will. Once everything's done and we've completed the burn, it's not over. The burn is usually still active in the sense that it's smoldering and things are residually burning out, but then we have to patrol it and make sure that it stays within the boundaries that we established. And we also monitor for smoke impacts and have people assigned to watch where our smoke goes to make sure that it's not impacting communities or roadways. And once the burn is complete, really the part that's exciting to me is seeing what happens afterwards, because so often plants will come out that we didn't know were there. You'll just see changes on the landscape. And so I always like to say the burn's not over for quite some time after we've finished. In the evenings at the Women's TREX, we had presentations every night. We also had our participants give what we call flash presentations, which are 5 to 7 minute talks on the topics of the participants' choice, and I felt like that was one of the best things about the event, because women who maybe were a little nervous about public speaking or had not had their confidence built up had an opportunity to practice in a really safe, supportive environment, getting in front of people and having their peers cheer them on and clap for them and help them out.
What were some of the topics that they chose to present on?
Some of the participants talked about the programs that they had at home. So if they were monitoring, for example, relationships between bird communities and prescribed fire, or some of them were just talking about my life, like, this is me and this is what I do, and when I'm not at work, you know, this is my life. One of our participants, who's from the Warm Springs Indian Reservation in Oregon, gave a really moving talk about what it's like to not just be a woman, but a minority woman in not just fire, but in life. And so she really gave us this wonderful glimpse into what it's like to be her, and talking about her elders in her life and her child and fire and what that meant for her.
We're hearing from Amanda Stamper. She's Fire Management Officer for the Nature Conservancy of Oregon. We also have Lenya Quinn Davidson with us from the University of California Cooperative Extension and the Northern California Prescribed Fire Council. We've got some callers on the line here. I'd like to go to Jeff in Medford. Jeff, welcome to the exchange.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, good morning, Amanda. I was working way back in the early 70s, 1970 or 71, in Klamath National Forest. I wasn't a professional firefighter. I was what they called a casual back then. And I worked with what I was told were the very first women hired by the U.S. Forest Service as professional firefighters. And I think that was 1971. And they did very well. And after that, a few years after that, the Forest Service started training local people, having this red carded or blue carded back then program, and a lot of the local women in that area became part-time firefighters in the summertime, and I thought they were accepted by almost everybody and did a very good job. And then later I worked with the Bureau of Land Management as a firefighter, and some of the 20-person interagency crews we went out with were, some of them were half women, I worked with female firefighters a lot and found them to be very, you know, very competent. And
sounds like a positive.
The only thing I could say is is physically it's sometimes difficult for females to have the same upper body strength as men, like when handling a chainsaw or something. But other than that, they seem like they're, I mean, I would say they should be included in all firefighting and fire suppression programs.
All right, Jeff, thank you for sharing your stories. Lenya, or I guess Amanda, in terms of him talking about the difference in physical strength, anything you would want to weigh on there? Do you get that kind of pushback from your male colleagues who say, hey, you just can't wield a chainsaw as well as I can?
Well, I personally wield a chainsaw as well as anyone.
Okay.
And I do it frequently still to this day. I think it's a matter of how you handle it. Women handle chainsaws a little differently than men, and they need to use different parts of their body. And I think that's one of the reasons why women teaching women is so important, because there is a default to, oh, well, women don't have this kind of upper body strength, but they have a lot of strength in their hips and in their legs. So a lot of times women can manage their equipment a little differently, but they need to be taught that if they don't figure it out themselves early on. And so I counter that with the fact that we have women at every level in the fire organization, from smoke jumpers down to the hand crews, and they perform equally with their male counterparts.
All right, we just got an email from John. He didn't give a town. He says, my daughter was on a hotshot crew, Baker River, I think, for several years, 10 to 12 years ago. She was the only woman sometimes and was valuable and valued, but she often questioned her ability to perform the same physical level as the men who were stronger. She also felt that there was an inappropriate level of protectiveness displayed by the men on the crew, leading to a possibly dangerous dynamic. Could you address that, John asks.
Well, that's interesting. I was in those shoes, I think, in terms of being the only woman, and there was the development of a protectiveness around me, but it was, I didn't feel like it ever distracted or formed any kind of an adverse situation that would cause my male counterparts to behave differently. But it kind of reminds me of some of the discussion around women in the military, and that there's a concern that in the heat of the battle, if a woman went down, there would be a diversion of attention to taking care of her as opposed to every man for himself or every woman for herself.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's something that we cannot overcome. I just think that's another part of the cultural transformation that we all need to engage and just keep moving forward through.
Mm-hmm. Let's get one more call in here. We've got Mary and Ashland on the line. Mary, you're on with Amanda Stamper from the Nature Conservancy and Lenya Quinn Davidson from the Northern California Prescribed Buyer Council.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm glad to hear this program because I just retired from a firefighting career in 2007. I was on a hotshot crew in 82, 83, and I started on a brush disposal crew in 1977 doing initial attack. And I just wanted to comment about that whole chainsaw thing. I was using a chainsaw for 3 years. Women have to use their legs a lot more than men, and they have to learn how to do that to rest the chainsaw on it. I still use a chainsaw today. And even though I couldn't do as many pull-ups as the hotshot, guys on the hotshot crew, my stick-to-itiveness and...
Hi, Mary. Sorry about that. Your stick-to-itiveness? Hey, Emily Pfeiffer, if you could turn down one of the guest pots, I think that'll help us out. Hey, Mary, you with us? Well, that's a shame. Mary in Ashland, thank you so much for sharing your personal experience as a woman and firefighter. We are just about out of time for this segment. I'm Emily Curitan, and working through some technical difficulties. A big thank you to Amanda Stamper from the Nature Conservancy of Oregon for sharing her experiences, and Lenya Quinn Davidson from the Northern California Prescribed Fire Council. Thank you both for being here and telling us about the Women in Fire Training Exchange that just wrapped up in Northern California.